Please open your Bibles to Acts chapter 18. This will be one of the texts that we'll be exploring in just a minute. We're glad that all of you are here. Hope the week has started well for you and for yours. For those of you that saw the Hogs wrestle the Gators to the ground yesterday in Fayetteville, I dusted this off because it was anthracite. And that's a way homer. I'll go on the way home and you'll figure it out. There are some folks out in the lobby that I want you to meet. They represent the foster care ministry of this congregation. There are many families that are doing a wonderful job opening up their hearts and their homes to these little ones that really have no place to go. And I want to tell you a story about that before we get into the lesson itself in just a couple of minutes. When I learned how to text a few years ago, when I got one of those phones that did that, a couple of my favorite people to text became Jared Ramey and Andrew Cheffins. And J-Rod and Cheffins, as I affectionately refer to them, are just full of all kinds of nonsensical thoughts and ideas. But they're both pretty humorous. And we go back and forth and back, usually about football and that sort of thing. So we've been doing this for years. If I ever run for office and the FBI uncovers all the text messages, there will be a lot of profound thoughts and funny things, not from them, but still. And last week, I came across something, and I thought, well, I got to send this to the two of them. Cheffins, like me, is a Yankee, and Jared is a Arkansas boy. And it was an article that talked about five of the top 12 teams in the BCS playoff countdown were from the Big Ten. And I thought, now, Cheffins is going to love that. Jared's going to hate it, but Jared's an only child, and he's really easy to poke at and get a reaction from, so I sent that out. And usually, he's a lot like those young people. You call them, you know, they won't answer the phone, but you text them, and within 5 seconds, you got a response. But in this case, he didn't send anything back, and I thought, surely he's got something to say, because, you know, that was pretty good poking there. And then, a few minutes later, he sends back a message. He said, oh, I'm sorry. It was hours later, in fact, I guess. And he said, I'm sorry I didn't get this. We've been busy all day with this. And he sent a picture. I think we had the picture. That is Levi. I didn't even realize that Jared and Sylvia were that close to being foster parents. And that is their new foster son. And I thought, now, you get a free pass not responding to one of my idiotic texts if you're taking care of a precious little one like that. But I'm proud of the Ramies. I'm proud of all of our families that are on the front lines in this fight for kids. They're doing the Lord's work. And if you'd like to know more about that, there'll be some folks out there representing, and you can talk to them. But praise God for such families that want to make a difference in the lives of these little ones. There's a quote by George Bernard Shaw that really ties in to this kind of action. It says, liberty means responsibility. That's why most men dread it. Think about people that would bring children into the world but then not be responsible enough to care for them. But on the other hand, think about people that are responsible enough that they step up and they do care for those little ones. That's really what we're talking about. One of the reasons the Apostle Paul was so effective in his service to Christ was the keen sense of responsibility that was within him. Writing to the Corinthians, he urges, brothers, each man is responsible to God, should remain in the situation that God called him to. Paul was likely here just addressing these words for a temporary frame of time, because as the church was going through a great time of turmoil and tumult, probably because of a famine, Paul was saying, just remain for the time being in the situation you find yourself in. But even more central to the point is that Paul couches this in his own and our own responsibility to God. Paul never was able to shake free of that idea that each of us is responsible as a free moral agent to the God who has made us. Responsibility wasn't something that Paul just preached. It was also something that he practiced. Notice the biblical text in Acts chapter 18, beginning in verse 1. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. Paul went to see them. And because he was a tent maker, as they were, he stayed and worked with them. Every Sabbath, he reasoned in the synagogue, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. But when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his own clothes in protest and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am clear of my responsibility. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." Paul never made a move. He never reached a decision. He never lived a day free from the idea that he would be responsible for himself to God. And that's the same feeling that you and I ought to carry with us every day. But it should generally go without saying that these days, many flee responsibility, like rats deserting a sinking ship. Our society even goes so far, while we're trying to push away our own responsibility, to invent ridiculous excuses to provide cover for those who do, such as in the case of Ethan Couch. You've probably heard of this young man, whether you realize it or not. But Ethan Anthony Couch was born April the 11th, 1997. An American teen who killed four people while drinking and driving on June the 15th, 2013, in Burleson, Texas. That night, he was illegally driving on a restricted license and speeding, lost control, plowing into a group of people standing near a disabled SUV and striking a parked vehicle which was there to assist. Four people were killed in this collision. Two passengers in Couch's truck suffered serious bodily injury, and a total of nine people in all were seriously hurt. Couch was indicted on four counts of intoxication manslaughter for recklessly driving under the influence. In December 2013, Judge Gene Hudson Boyd sentenced Couch to 10 years of probation and subsequently ordered him to therapy in a long-term inpatient facility. After his attorneys had famously argued that the teen was suffering from something called affluenza. Now, that's not to be confused with influenza, which is actually real. Affluenza is where you have so much money that you just don't know the difference anymore between right and wrong. Couch's sentence, avoiding prison, was believed by many to be incredibly lenient, and it set off what the New York Times called an emotional, angry debate that has stretched far beyond the North Texas suburbs. It turns out, peeling the layers of the onion back a little bit, that this wasn't anything new in this young man's life or in the life of his parents. Couch's parents had married in Texas in 1996 and divorced in 2007. He grew up in Burleson and attended the Anderson Private School. While there, Couch made the practice of driving himself to school at the tender age of 13. When the head of the school questioned that practice, his father threatened to buy the school and have the principal fired. Couch withdrew from Anderson and began attending a co-op in a neighboring town. At 15, he stopped attending that program. Before the incident, he was enrolled in a community college. At the age of 15, Couch was cited for minor in consumption of alcohol and minor in possession of alcohol, after he was caught in a parked pickup truck with a naked, passed-out 14-year-old girl. He pleaded no contest to that and was sentenced to probation, a compulsory alcohol awareness class, and 12 hours of community service. Now, if you wonder where he learned such an example, you probably don't have to guess very long. His parents have also had their own legal problems, publicized in the media following their son's conviction. Fred Couch, his father, had been charged with criminal mischief, theft by check, and assault. But miraculously, the charges were dropped. On August the 19th, 2014, he was arrested for impersonating a police officer, allegedly displaying a fake badge during a disturbance call. In 2013, Couch's mother, Tanya, was sentenced to a $500 fine and six-month community supervision order for reckless driving when she used her vehicle to force another motorist off the road. On the evening of June the 15th, 2013, according to authorities and trial testimony, Couch was witnessed on surveillance video stealing two cases of beer from a Walmart store, driving with seven passengers in his father's red 2012 Ford pickup, and speeding, going 70 miles an hour in a 40-mile-an-hour zone. 3 hours after the incident, he still had a blood alcohol content of 0.24%, three times the legal limit for adult drivers in Texas. And he also tested positive for marijuana and Valium. Approximately an hour after the beer theft, Couch was driving his father's truck at high speeds on a rural two-lane Burleson Road when motorist Brianna Mitchell's sport utility vehicle had stalled. Holly Boyles and her daughter Shelby, who lived nearby, had come out to help her, as had a young youth minister who was passing by the scene, a man by the name of Brian Jennings. Couch's truck swerved off the road and into Mitchell's SUV, then plowed into Jennings's parked car, which in turn hit an oncoming Volkswagen. The truck then flipped over and hit a tree. Mitchell, Jennings, and both Boyles were killed, while Couch and his seven teenage passengers, none wearing seatbelts, survived, although one would be paralyzed for the rest of his life, as did the two children in Jennings' car and the two people in the Volkswagen. In the aftermath of this, Couch was charged with four counts of intoxication manslaughter and two counts of intoxication assault. Tarrant County prosecutors were seeking a maximum sentence of 20 years of imprisonment for Ethan Couch. But the Couch family hired a psychologist by the name of G. Dick Miller, an expert, according to the defense, and he testified in court that Ethan Couch was a product of affluenza and was thus unable to link his actions with consequences because of his parents teaching him all of these years that wealth buys privilege. It would be initially reported that as part of his sentencing, since the judge did not send him to prison, was that he would be sent to a rehabilitation center in Newport Beach, California, which cost nearly $500,000 a year. And the facility and part of its 90-day treatment offers horseback riding, mixed martial arts, massage and cookery, interpretive dance therapy, a swimming pool, basketball, and 6 acres of land. You probably have heard in the intervening time that Couch's problems have not ended. Even though he avoided getting sent to prison, he's violated probation several times. He skipped the country with his mother and went to Mexico, where authorities picked him up in Puerto Vallarta. And today, he sits in the Tarrant County Jail, probably going to do a couple of years at least this time. So what do you make of all of that? As a relatively well-off, middle-class white man, let me say it this way. If Ethan Couch were poor, if Ethan Couch were black, if Ethan Couch were an immigrant, they would have put him under the jail. And you know that. This is a case of wealth and privilege getting someone out of what they ought to have to face the music for doing. Parents whose wealth and connections enable them to protect their children from the consequences of their actions are doing great damage to them. I don't know any other way to say it than that. I never doubted for a minute when I was growing up, if someone treated me unfairly, that my mother and father would come to my defense. I knew that. I also knew this. If I'd gone out and acted the fool, I was going to have reason to fear my father more than I'd fear everyone else put together. And this young man didn't have it. Christian writer Randy Alcorn makes an interesting comment. He says, parents who spoil their children out of love should realize that they're performing acts of child abuse. Although there are no laws against such abuse, no man-made laws anyway, this spiritual mistreatment may result in as much long-term personal and social damage as the worst physical abuse. Brothers and sisters, you know in your heart he's telling the truth. Anytime we imagine that our position in society or our wealth gives us a free pass, we're sinning. We're sinning against God. We're sinning against our children. We're sinning against our fellow man. But then again, is this news? It's been going on forever. It's not limited to the wealthy. It's not just limited to this ethnic group or that group. This misguided notion that no one is really responsible for anything has been around since God created human beings. The first man, the first woman, were infected with this idea of entitlement and the evasion of responsibility. Look at Genesis 3:12, the passage that Brother Brent read a minute ago. As God comes looking for Adam and Eve and recognizes that they've done the one thing he told them not to do, he doesn't come to Eve, he comes to Adam. Why is that? Because Adam was put in charge. Adam was the leader of the family. Adam was given the responsibility of caring for his wife and protecting her. And while she goes out and sins first, she at least seemingly had an idea about what she was doing. He just did it and didn't even think. So God comes to Adam and he says, "What is this that you have done?" And in one sentence, Adam brilliantly blames both Eve and God. "The woman that you put here with me." In other words, it's your fault and it's her fault. I would encourage you to read the rest of the chapter. God wasn't buying it. He wasn't then, and he's not now. Maybe the most audacious excuse since Adam blamed God and Eve in one fell swoop was given in a 1902 speech to prisoners in Chicago's Cook County Jail. The person doing the speaking to those prisoners was the famed defense attorney Clarence Darrow. There have not been 10 lawyers whose fame has exceeded his in the history of our republic. But Darrow stood up there in Chicago and proclaimed to the prisoners that crime and responsibility have absolutely nothing to do with each other. Listen to what he says. "There is no such thing as crime, as the word is generally understood. I do not believe people are in jail because they deserve to be. They are in jail simply because they cannot avoid it, on account of circumstances which are entirely beyond their control and for which they are in no way responsible." In other words, it's not anybody's fault. What complete and utter nonsense that is. That's ridiculous. And we know better. Jesus says in Matthew 12:36, "We will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every careless word we have spoken." If we're going to have to give an account for everything we've said, it goes without saying that we will for everything we've done. And Paul says in Romans 14:12, "So then each of us will give an account of himself to God." And we can make up every excuse under the sun to justify ourselves. But one day, you and I will have to stand before the righteous judge. And you know what won't work on that day? Well, you know, it was my parents. You know, they kind of, you know, didn't do a great job with me. Or, as you know, my spouse. You know, if he wouldn't have been so useless, I would have been better off. Or, you know, if my kids hadn't, you know, gone crazy or whatever. I'm not saying that there aren't things that affect us. Of course there are. We all face those things. But at the end of the day, it's just going to be you. And you're going to stand before the Lord. And the Lord is going to ask you to give an account of your life. How have you lived? What have you believed? How have you treated people? How have you spent your money? How have you allocated your time? Have you cared anything for anyone other than yourself? These things will matter, according to Jesus. And here's something I've also noticed about this accountability that we cannot escape. We're not going to be judged as groups. We love doing things in groups. And you know, we love going to athletic events with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. But we're not going to go before God in that sense. We're not even going to stand before God as denizens of Little Rock. Nor will we stand before God at the judgment and say, well, I was part of the Pleasant Valley Church. We did a lot of great things for the cause of Christ. We're not going to stand before God as families. We're going to stand before God as men and women, individually. And God is going to ask, what about you? What did you do with the opportunities I gave you? What did you do with the talents that I invested in you? What did you do with the abilities that you were endowed with? What did you do? That's what God's going to want to know. And I can't point the finger at anybody else. Because you know, when you point the finger at somebody else, there's three of them pointing back at you. So then, each of us will give an account of himself to God. I see things in society that just make me sick. And when I'd heard about the story of Ethan Couch, I thought, this is yet one more miscarriage of justice. It happens all the time. Because of who you know or how much money you have. Here's the thing. Do you think anybody is getting away with anything at the judgment? No chance. The God of justice knows all things. The only thing that's going to matter at that day is, how did you live your life? And did you have Jesus as your defense attorney? Because, you know, I'm not going to stand up and be saved by my own innate goodness. I'm going to be saved when Jesus stands up and says, you know, Chuck was a bit of a handful. He was a piece of work sometimes. And sometimes he didn't always do what he should have done. But you know something? He always tried. He always did his best. When he fell down, he got back up. And besides which, he was for me. You can have that. Jesus says, whoever acknowledges me before men, him will I acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. Friends, we're going to be responsible, but if we have Jesus on our side, we have nothing to fear. Can you make that claim today? If you can't, you need to obey the gospel while there's yet time, in faith, repentance, and baptism. Or if you're already a Christian, but you've wandered away and tried to evade that responsibility to which you've been called, you can make a change today and come back to him. There's a spiritual need that you have. Won't you bring that up before the Father even now? Won't you come?